Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. More than a quarter century has passed since the signing of the Paris Peace Accords. Ostensibly, the agreement was intended to bring the Vietnam War to a close, but that conflict would drag on for two further bitter years. The ambiguities and confusion of that peace process offer object lessons in the elusiveness of obtaining even limited political objectives in the charged atmosphere of major conflicts. These lessons are only now emerging from the careful study of previously classified documents. At a time when the United States and its allies are seeking a cessation of hostilities and an effective political settlement in a different part of the world, these Vietnam-era lessons are more important than ever. My guest is Larry Berman, professor of political science at the University of California, Davis. Larry, welcome to Dialogue.
Pleasure to be here, George.
Larry, let me start this way. I think it was Graham Martin, who was the last American ambassador to then-South Vietnam, who said that, and these I think were his words, there was a hell of an untold story behind the Vietnam peace negotiations. And I think that's exactly the story you intend to tell in the book you're writing. And I thought one way of getting into that story and getting your sense of the things you're concerned with might be to examine three pivotal points, starting precisely with the day of 31st of March, 1968. That's the day Lyndon Johnson, I take it, says he's not going to run for re-election. He says he is going to devote his efforts to securing a peace, extricating the U.S. from that conflict. The first question is this, Larry. It seems to me that would set up a contest of wills of a different kind between the U.S. and the North Vietnamese. And if that's the case, did that declaration and the obvious fact that the major power in the world wanted to get out of the war, did that give a psychological advantage to the North Vietnamese in what came after in the peace process?
I think that March 31st, 1968, the day that Lyndon Johnson did say that he would not accept nor would he seek the Democratic nomination of his party, was a pivotal day and a key signal to North Vietnamese that the United States eventually, within 1 year perhaps, or 5 years or 10 years, had every intention of withdrawing from Vietnam. It changed the entire dialogue, the political dialogue, of what could and could not become a negotiated settlement in Vietnam. The war was not going to be won militarily any longer. You know, I have two powerful images of Lyndon Johnson. I remember this day in 1968, and I remember people shouting in the streets, "The hawk is dead, the hawk is dead," which was a very powerful image of the fact that the transformation of a great reforming political president who only wanted to improve the quality of life in America, and the tragic story of how he had become a war president. And that other image, of course, that I have is the day that he invoked the words of Martin Luther King when he asked Americans to join him following the assassination of President John Kennedy to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it is that tragic story of the transformation from a moral leader, a president who had wanted to only improve the quality of life in America, to this day on March 31st, where he had become really a symbol of the war in Vietnam.
I can't resist asking you this, Larry, because you have written about Lyndon Johnson so thoughtfully. Do you see him as one of the great tragic figures of American political history?
Absolutely. I see him as a, you know, it's interesting to compare him with Lyndon Johnson with Richard Nixon often. And I think actually President Lyndon Johnson, he fell from a higher place. That is, his fall was so draconic and so quick. He had the chance, and he really only wanted to be the greatest president in American history for what he could do to improve the quality of life for all Americans. Yeah. I believe from studying Johnson and from listening to other biographers talk of Johnson, from reading the record, here was a man who really, if Vietnam just could have gone away, or it never happened, that was the way he wanted it. And he only wanted to prove to the world, and there were some psychological reasons as well, that this president who had grown up dirt poor on the Pernod Allies River, someone, an accidental president who probably never could have become president, in his own right, but because of a bullet became president. And this sort of edge he had to prove to the world that, well, the guys from Harvard, they didn't have what it took to become this kind of great reforming president, but he could.
Yeah,
I think he's a great tragic figure. And of course, by 1968, he had personalized all of this
exactly.
To such an extent that on March 31st, I think he thought that by resigning, that or announced that he would not accept the renomination of his party, that the war itself would go away. And of course, it didn't. It not only didn't go away, it lasted for another 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. Lyndon Johnson strikes me, Larry, and I'm sure from what you've just said, it's true. There's a complex figure, a figure who merits that overused phrase, larger than life in many ways. And now, on the 31st of March, as you say, Larry, when he makes this declaration, he's I guess, hopeful that the end is near, is going to be approached. But as you point out, the end is not near. The North Vietnamese know it's now a negotiating battle, in a sense. Are they mindful as they do that, Larry, as they enter this negotiation phase, of their own recent history? And what I'm referring to here is in 1954, they'd undergone a kind of protracted and difficult set of negotiations with the French. So, I mean, they clearly had a sense of perhaps being betrayed or underserved one time, and a very clear sense of what they want to get this time. Or am I right in that?
Oh, you're right. And I think one of the interesting things that I've learned in writing this book, and that's come out really, and thanks to the Cold War Project here at the Wilson Center as well, is that the Vietnamese felt betrayed by what had happened at Geneva, but betrayed by the Chinese and the Soviets, and that indeed they had when I say the word betrayed, they had accomplished a military victory, and they thought they deserved more of the piece of the pie than they got, and the mere promise of an election to be held in 1954. And they vowed to themselves that this would never happen again. And the tensions that created between the North Vietnamese and the Chinese and the Russians is really quite evident now from the declassified archives, both from the Chinese and from the Soviets, that this was not going to happen again. Now, when Johnson announced that he was not going to seek re-election, the key there was, of course, that he also declared a bombing halt and a bombing of North Vietnam. And this was the thing that the North Vietnamese had insisted on, that we won't negotiate and we won't sit down with you until you stop the bombing. And so there was also this bombing halt. And, of course, then we were led into this long, long battle of the shape of a table and everything else that went on with it. But the North Vietnamese understood something else, that, you know, between 1965 and 1968, Lyndon Johnson had increased the military commitment from about 55,000 American troops to 550,000 American troops. And we were no closer to achieving our limited political objective, either through the use of strategic air strikes, through defoliation, through mining, through an extraordinary logistical setup at Cameron Bay and other places, and the sending of all these troops over there.
Yeah.
We were no closer. And they understood that from this moment on, the American story would be one of de-escalation and of withdrawal of troops. This is before the term Vietnamization became popular, but they understood this was the beginning. And, you know, the Vietnamese had fought oppressors for centuries. To them, what was another 1 year or 5 years? Mm-hmm. And they understood American politics far better than I think at the time people were willing to give them credit for, because democracies have a problem sometimes with things called newspapers and public opinion, anti-war movement, and the like.
I think you're absolutely right, Larry, as in so many other things, about the astute reading of the American status and intentions by the North Vietnamese. And you use that word betrayal, that the betrayal they sensed, they felt as early as the 1950s in the earlier peace agreements. That word is going to recur in our conversation. I'm going to ask you a question about that in a different context in a minute. But Larry, let me ask you this right now, because it seems that it is clear from the American perspective that, as the working title of your book suggests, an imperfect peace was really what was accomplished in those Paris Accords, and hence one that, in one measure or another, was sort of doomed to fail. Why, essentially, do you put that verdict on it? I mean, what was flawed about it? What's the imperfection in this?
I mean, when we go back and look at this, President Nixon called it, of course, peace with honor. And just today I was writing a part of the book in which I was going through all the editorials nationwide and worldwide the day the treaty was signed. And by and large, President Nixon received great credit for what was called peace with honor, that he had not taken the peace that the anti-war movement had so readily wanted him to, which was to leave President II of South Vietnam, which was to dump President II, and he had held out a long time for that. And of course, it was an honorable peace from Nixon's perspective because we got the return of our POWs, or at least most of our POWs. The question of whether or not there was ever a full accounting of the MIAs is a fair one to ask. But it was an imperfect peace because it allowed, the treaty allowed 150,000 North Vietnamese to remain in South Vietnam. Hmm. The United States had started off with a very strong bargaining position of mutual withdrawal. We would withdraw our troops, and the North Vietnamese would withdraw their troops. Somewhere in 1970, Lee Duc Tho got Henry Kissinger or Richard Nixon, and Richard Nixon to back off from that. And these 150,000 troops were allowed to stay in South Vietnam. President Tu opposed this up until the very end. And that's one of the elements for it. One of the reasons I call it an imperfect peace, because we now know in hindsight that having half the regular North Vietnamese army in South Vietnam in a ceasefire in place created a very, very difficult situation. The treaty was unenforceable. And the only thing that made it enforceable and the only reason that President Tu went along with it was because Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon had promised President Tu that if there were any violations of this treaty, the Americans would return with the B-52s and punish North Vietnam. Now, there were two other aspects of the treaty that made it an imperfect peace. One was the fact that elections were to be held, but there was no enforcement mechanism to hold those elections. And it's really quite clear that President Tu had no intention whatsoever of holding those elections. And then on the DMZ and on infiltration, there was almost no way to control the issue of infiltration down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Okay, Larry, those are very precise points and very articulately put forth. So let me ask you some sort of aftermath questions, if I may, given that these were the imperfections of that treaty. Maybe this is the key one. Because of the perception by President Tu that there was this reentry promise, this guarantee that he would be backed up if things got out of hand after the North Vietnamese troops were, as you point out, present in his country. Were they betrayed? Was South Vietnam betrayed by this agreement?
Without a doubt, I think they were betrayed, and the subtitle of my forthcoming book is the final betrayal of South Vietnam, and this is it's a very crucial distinction that I make in this book. And I've had to really think it through, and I've talked to a lot of Vietnamese about it. And this is how my thinking on it goes. Sometimes we forget that President Nixon in 1968 ran on the platform that he had a secret plan to end the war. And between 1969 and 1972, his entire first term, the United States had withdrawn almost 500,000 troops, but we had expanded the war geographically into two countries. And then, of course, Nixon is reelected, a massive election victory over George McGovern. And he now is facing, because of the 22nd Amendment, his final 4 years in office. And he instructs Henry Kissinger in January of 1973, just get the best deal you can. We've got to put Vietnam behind us because we've got these great foreign policy successes with China and the Soviet Union. And Kissinger goes back to Paris and they settle.
Yeah.
And President Tu didn't want to sign on the treaty, and we now know from the new documents that Kissinger and Nixon threatened President Tu that if he didn't sign, that the United States would merely cut their own private deal with the North Vietnamese POWs for getting out. You know, we'll get out, give us back our POWs, and we're gone. And they convinced President Tu that if you sign this, we'll back up the treaty. And the backing up the treaty was with the B-52s. Now, this is before Watergate. And the fact of the matter is that the only reason President Tu and the only reason the Vietnamese went along with it was because they expected the Americans to be there for not just 2 years or 5 years, but for a decade or two.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Larry Berman, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Larry Berman, professor of political science at the University of California, Davis, and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Larry, I want to ask you a question about domestic affairs of the time and their effect on this whole question of even pursuing the Paris Peace Accords. And of course, here I'm referring to Watergate. That was the big story here domestically. That imperiled a presidency, well, ultimately ended a presidency. What effect did it have on the conduct of the Nixon-Kissinger conduct of the peace agreement talks?
This is something that both Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger have been very clear on, and Watergate prevented them from backing up the Paris Accords that were signed in 1973. We know that in March and April of 1973, President Nixon, at Kissinger's urging, received an order to the bombing of the Ho Chi Minh Trail be renewed again, because the North were indeed violating the treaty and infiltrating down the trail. This is something that Nixon and Kissinger had anticipated in December of 1972 and in January of 1973, and by March or April it was occurring. So there was the expectation, as 4 months earlier than the order was issued, for renewed bombing and bring the bombers back to honor this pledge that we had given to the South Vietnamese. But because of Watergate, Nixon felt, because there's no doubt this would have led to a constitutional crisis of great magnitude, the Congress had turned anti-war. There was very little public support for going back to Vietnam, even the B-52s. And one of the reasons is that in the Christmas bombing of 1972, we had suffered extreme losses in a number of pilots shot down, and the North Vietnamese had actually captured a significant number of POWs during this period, and that there was very little interest in Congress in seeing this occur again. Watergate, though, prevented even Nixon from carrying that order through. He rescinded it, and in his own memoirs and in Kissinger's memoirs and in various public forums, they both stated that Watergate emasculated the president. That's the term that Kissinger uses. It prevented him from going full thor against the North Vietnamese. And as a result, the end, of course, came in April of 1975.
I want to talk about that too, Larry, April 1975. I don't think anyone who was alive then can forget the helicopter lifting off the American embassy roof in Saigon. Of course, if you didn't see it then, you could see it in Miss Saigon now, you know, the musical. It's one of these great epic scenes of what did it mean? I mean, what did it mean for the United States to, as a result of this imperfect peace, end up departing in that kind of disarray?
Well, it's led to a battle that continues even today about the meaning of Vietnam, the lessons. Can a country with limited political objectives commit its forces overseas and achieve its goals? Just a few years ago, during a different foreign policy crisis, words were evoked by the vice president and by other military leaders that this is not going to be another Vietnam. Okay, we're not going to go in with one hand tied behind our back and the like. When we were going after Saddam, for example, or in the Persian Gulf, and it led to a great battle in America over the memory of Vietnam and the identity. And this, to me, is the most important. That is, that image, that context of the war created in this country first the feeling of humiliation. And first, tragically, people equated the war with the warriors. And as a result, the people who had served in Vietnam were stigmatized by the way that war ended, quite tragically. It wasn't until, I think, a decade later when the movement started to build the Vietnam Memorial, for example. And then, of course, now today, I think we've come a full turn on that, where we not only honor those who served in Vietnam and those who lost their lives, but it took a long time. And that image of that helicopters going off of the embassy roof, I think, had a lot to do with it.
Actually, with that comment, Larry, you suggest another thing I wanted to ask you about in the same line of legacies of this conflict, or legacies of the imperfect peace, perhaps more properly stated. And of course, domestically, for a large part of our population, particularly those veterans and their families, the question of the POWs and the MIAs still is very much with us, very vivid. No one can spend Memorial Day weekend in Washington without realizing how palpable that issue still is. To go back to its origins, in that 60-day period, I believe, and between January 27th, 1973, it was supposed to be a 60-day period, was there not, in which these people were to be returned, our prisoners, and accounted for?
That's correct.
What happened?
Well, a lot happened and a lot didn't happen. There was a discrepancy between the number of names on our list, that is, the number of POWs we thought we were going to get back, and the number that we did. And, of course, once they didn't come back, they were classified as missing in action. And this started out as numbers in the thousands. And the fact is that still there has not been a complete accounting for those who have been lost, and we don't know where they are, whether or not they are still being kept against their will, as so many people who came just this past Memorial Day to Washington believe, or whether or not they are long since gone, but there's no full record of where they are and how they were killed, perhaps because they were tortured and put into some met a horrible death. And of course, the Kerry Committee and the United States Congress did do a complete complete investigation of this a few years ago, but it still has not satisfied the MIA activists, and I can understand that. And the real question is why was there a difference in these lists? And there was also the question of the political detainees. I mean, while there's never been a full accounting of our own lost servicemen, the fact is as well that there's never been a full accounting of the thousands and thousands and thousands of political detainees who were North Vietnamese in South Vietnamese jails, and where are they gone? And this whole thing got really messed up after the 60 days, whenever period was over.
So flawed right from the start.
Right from the start. Yeah. There was almost no enforcement mechanism. Mm-hmm. And indeed, peace with honor for Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger meant a return of the American POWs and putting Vietnam behind us. I mean, there is a book called A Decent Interval, and of course the question was, what would be enough time before we could accept the fall of South Vietnam?
Yeah. Larry, if we took the many points you've made and linked them together, this sense of betrayal on the part of the South Vietnamese, even though he's now a resident in the United States, the question of the POW, MIA legacy, and still very much with us, and many other points that you've made, I'm mindful that we're now engaged in a conflict which, to use a phrase you used earlier, is built around the notion of a noble cause. It's now coming to what we hope may be its end game. But if the end game reflects in any degree what I think you referred to as a woefully inadequate peace agreement, that is the Vietnam-era agreement, then it seems we're in for greater trouble. So what are the lessons? I mean, what should people be aware of now in facing the Kosovo situation, the business we did not intend to, and ending the Vietnam conflict?
It's an excellent question, and you know, my answer changes almost every day because, to be quite honest, 2 weeks ago, or at least when it looked like bombing, I really did believe that there was a unusual faith in what strategic bombing could do, and the argument would be that the bombs weren't going to bring about a peace agreement, that it was inevitable that troops would be brought in, and there, of course, that Vietnam analogy comes full bore. I actually think in this case, President Clinton did a much better job, and NATO did a much better job in articulating its political objectives than Lyndon Johnson ever did in terms of how we got in, and were quite honest about what they thought the stakes were. I mean, Lyndon Johnson was a president who said, "I'm not going to send American boys to fight in a nation's civil war." And he said, "If you want a war and you want to send American boys to Vietnam, then elect Barry Goldwater in 1964. But if you want peace and you want a great society, elect me." I think President Clinton, one of the lessons he learned, at least from reading history and certainly from what people told him, was to be clear with the American public about what the issues were and what the goals were. I do think the analogy, though, is quite appropriate when we talk about treaty enforcement and what will happen if there are violations during the treaty enforcement period, and what are we prepared to do, and will the president and will NATO be clear with the world as to what will happen if there are violations of the treaty, which I'm still not convinced as of our conversation will be successfully implemented. We'll have to wait and see.
But enforcement and clarity about enforcement are key.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the president has done a very good job in talking about what is and what is not a vital strategic interest or a security interest, or what is and is not in Europe's interest or in NATO's interest and in America's interest. These were things that were never fully articulated in the 1960s and 70s, except in broad terms like the domino theory or containment. And the fact of the matter is that we had presidents who did not educate the public perhaps as well as the public is being educated today on this issue. It's also a little different in the sense that we're, at least in the United States, we're at a period of extreme economic security right now. And I've been struck by the lack of interest, not in what is going on overseas right now. I mean, it's extraordinary if you think about it, what NATO has done, what the United States has done, and when we think about the lack of casualties, I mean, it really is amazing. I mean, I think if we took 100 Apache helicopters and flew them around the United States today, just on a trial basis, we might have more losses than we had in this entire episode. And as a result, I think, because of lack of casualties, the satisfaction with the way the economy is going, people seem just totally disinterested in this. I mean, you know, you can't walk down the street and have a conversation with someone about it. And that's striking to me.
Mm-hmm. Me as well. It really is. And I think just for the reasons you say, I think the economy and the sort of general happy state of things domestically has a lot to do with that. Larry, to conclude our conversation, I want to ask you a question concerning Imperfect Peace, the book, as you are writing it, when after this conversation, I think I and everyone listening is going to look forward to reading it. And I know that you are attempting to do things that haven't been done before, and it's relying a lot on unclassified material that previously wasn't available. What do you see, or what are you striving for as a kind of the central contribution of this book you're writing?
I hope the central contribution will be that the general public and scholars will go to it as the first book they would read after the Kissinger-Nixon memoirs. That is, one of the wonderful things about scholarship and the advancement of knowledge is that we just can't let these first cuts at history stand. And George Orwell had this wonderful line in something he wrote, and which he said, the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. And I believe that encapsulates so much of the Imperfect Peace. And I'm trying to tell the story that the president did not want told, and to me, it's one of the challenges of scholarship to wait 3 decades to get these documents declassified and to be able to tell the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey said. And I hope that there might be some lessons for this for protracted peace negotiations and general lessons for those who are interested in the whole question of treaty making, treaty enforcement, and political history.
Larry, it sounds like a valuable contribution. I look forward to seeing it and reading it.
Well, thank you, George. It's been a pleasure to be your guest.
It's my pleasure. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Larry Berman, professor of political science at the University of California, Davis. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Kirsten DeBelko. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.